A very busy show wrapping up a busy week, Friday, March 19th, 2021 on Connecticut Today. We welcomed back our friend Fiona Farine to the show. She, along with a bunch of folks who have lost loved ones to the scourge of drug addiction and drug use, are now setting their sights on another emerging drug problem in Connecticut. Joe Scully in the 4 o'clock hour from the Motor Transport Association in the state, breaking out some numbers as to how this proposed truck use fee coming from the governor's office could affect local trucking companies, and would they pass that added cost down to the consumer level. And in the 5 o'clock hour, Republican state senator and restaurateur Paul Formica joined us. He first talked about his restaurant going back to 100% capacity, and also the apparent agreement between the state and the two Indian tribes for legalized sports gambling and iGaming in the state. And I had some thoughts on recent statements from New Haven Mayor Justin Elliker regarding zoning regulations in some southwestern Connecticut Fairfield County-based towns. Yeah, and speaking of Fairfield County, Stamford, and all that, the mayor of New Haven, did you see this? And I'll get to this in a couple of minutes here. The mayor of New Haven, who I think is actually a Fairfield County guy by birth, Justin Elliker, he's in a war of words now with at least the town leadership in Greenwich, Fred Camillo, the first selectman there, former state rep and everything, about, you know, racism keeping people of color out of Greenwich and New Canaan and some of these lower Fairfield County towns. Folks, I'm telling you, you folks in Fairfield County, Greenwich, Stamford, New Canaan, Wilton, Weston, and look, even if they don't say every city or town, they mean it. Okay. A lot of people like to pick on Greenwich because it's kind of the standard bearer of, you know, the Gold Coast right on the border with New York. Everybody, oh, Greenwich, yes, and Greenwich Murphy. You know, but when they talk about Fairfield County and Greenwich and Stamford, they're talking about the whole area. So all this extra taxation, which thankfully the governor says not happening on my watch, which is good. He's looking at some more fees and counterbalances to that. But all that stuff, the zoning stuff, it's all aimed at you folks in lower Fairfield County. Because according to some municipal leaders in this state, you're racist. You are racist. In fact, let me do that now. This actually popped up. One story popped up today. A buddy sent me this. This popped up today. The headline, New Haven mayor will not apologize for saying Greenwich uses zoning to keep out communities of color. There you go. Justin Elliker saying that this keeps out, zoning keeps folks of color, POC as they say, people of color out of Greenwich. This is from the Greenwich Times. The Insider column in the Greenwich Times, Hearst newspaper. A number of Greenwich's political leaders demanding an apology from Mayor Justin Elliker in New Haven after he said Greenwich is among the towns in Connecticut that have discriminatory housing policies that, quote, keep out communities of color. Elliker said yesterday, though, he's not going to apologize. During this public hearing on a bill, a couple of days ago, this Senate Bill 1024, Justin Elliker said, the mayor of New Haven, so listen up, you folks, and oh, he mentions New Canaan here, okay? So you folks in New Canaan, up in Woodbridge, too, that's a northern suburb of New Haven. I lived in New Haven a block from the Woodbridge-New Haven line. The Woodbridge-New Haven line was essentially my backyard. The boundary on my backyard, I believe, was actually the Woodbridge line or maybe 100 feet short of it, something like that. Justin Elliker, the mayor of New Haven, saying during this public hearing the other day, places, this is a quote now, places like Greenwich and Woodbridge and New Canaan and other towns are using zoning to keep out communities of color. Let's be clear about it, Elliker said. These practices had historically been done explicitly, are now done in a way that's more creative. Now, he was told or pushed on this. Let's see. State Rep. Kimberly Fiorello, Republican Greenwich, said, quote, "You made an incredible accusation against my town, and I'd like to understand how to wrap my mind around it." She asked Ms. Fiorello, got to get her on the show, she said she wanted Elliker to enlighten her about how Greenwich had been discriminatory. She said, quote, "This is illegal activity. To use zoning to keep people out is absolutely illegal." Under questioning from Fiorello, Elliker said Greenwich is predominantly white. Fiorello said Greenwich is very diverse. It's got, in fact, a 27% non-white population. Oh, man. So, see, the left in this state will say, well, 27% means a majority isn't. I'm telling you, it's folks, race, the new thing now is, again, race, and it's race and transgender. They need, the left always needs, like, these ice picks to hit you with. Fiorello's saying Greenwich has a 27% non-white population. She said, quote, "You can keep saying it. It doesn't make it true. Unless you have real evidence to prove it, I think it's quite a statement for Mayor Elliker to be making against the town of Greenwich." There you go. So there you go. You folks in Lower Fairfield County, Greenwich, Woodbridge, New Canaan, your towns are using their laws to keep out people of color. Even though, you know, non-white population in Greenwich, according to State Rep. Fiorello, is 27%. So, is 27% a majority? I don't think so. Now, Elliker went on to say, he was contacted Thursday. He said, quote, "Justin Elliker, the mayor of New Haven, saying, I will not apologize. We live in one of the most segregated states in the nation. There's a history of explicit racism in all our towns in our state, Greenwich and New Haven included. Today, structural racism persists throughout our state. The difference is that some communities like ours in New Haven are working to address it, and other communities like Greenwich and many other Connecticut towns are fighting to protect zoning regs that perpetuate structural racism." So you folks in Lower Fairfield County that don't want the state to bigfoot your zoning regulations, guess what? You are perpetuating structural racism, according to the mayor of New Haven, Justin Elliker. However, when contacted yesterday, Greenwich State Rep. Democrat Stephen Meskers did point to diversity in the town, particularly in his district along the shoreline. Metzger's saying, quote, "Over 32% of my district are people of color. The majority are 23% Latinx. 52% of my constituents live in owner-occupied dwellings. 48% of them rent. I've walked my entire district for two consecutive electoral cycles. I am confident of our inclusiveness and diversity." Again, that's State Rep. Stephen Meskers, Democrat Greenwich. But Representative Meskers, Representative Fiorello, you don't know this. You don't know your district. Justin Elliker, the mayor of New Haven, he knows. He knows the evil that lurks in the hearts of people in Lower Fairfield County. First, I want to talk about, and welcome back a person who's been on this show a few times before, the scourge that continues about drugs in our city. We welcome back Fiona Cullinan-Farine, who's been on the show before. You may remember, folks, about a year, year and a half ago, she, her husband, who's an old high school friend of mine, and other families were able to get the General Assembly to move at a speed I've never seen before and actually tighten up and boost some of the sentencing regulations for drugs, including fentanyl. And Fiona and her husband lost their son, Cameron, to fentanyl. They now run the Facebook website, the Facebook site for Cameron. So check that out. And on that website, on that Facebook site at Fort Cameron, you're going to find a video of a news conference held earlier today on Zoom with Among Folks, Lisa Dean, who she works with, and State Rep Vin Candelora, the Republican House Minority Leader, about another very grave problem concerning drugs in our area. Fiona, hi, it's Paul again. How are you?
I'm fine, Paul. Thank you so much for having me back on.
Well, anytime, Fiona, because when you sent me what you sent me, I gave it a quick read and said, absolutely. You've already done, you and your husband Joe and Lisa Dean and her family and everyone involved here, you've already done a great job. You got the General Assembly off the shtick quicker than I've ever seen at heightening some penalties for drug offenses in this state. Now, I know your folks are getting together again, Fiona, and you want to warn Connecticut and bring to the attention of legislators another problem. Now what's going on?
Well, you know, Paul, when Cameron died exactly 3 years ago, yesterday, actually, and when Cameron died, there was not a lot of understanding or knowledge in our state about the circumstances that led to his death. So what killed Cameron is he bought three pills. He thought what he was buying was pharmaceutical-grade OxyContin. What he actually bought was pure fentanyl, which is a deadly opioid. And the pill that Cameron took was pressed in disguise to look like a normal pharmaceutical-grade OxyContin. It takes 2,000 micrograms of fentanyl to kill someone. At 2,000 micrograms, that's unrecoverable. Narcan is not going to bring them back. And the pill that Cameron took was 11,000 micrograms. That's 9,000 micrograms over the absolute death dosage of fentanyl. So we are in a crisis of opportunity, but there has not been a lot of knowledge on the fact that these pills are poison being pressed and that they are being put out there. And so kids are feeling that they're making a safer choice. They feel they're taking a Xanax, an OxyContin. They feel like they're taking something and that it's actually a pharmaceutical drug, so it's safer. And in the meantime, dealers have compounded poison and stamped it to look like those pills and are putting them out there.
You know, Fiona, just on the surface of that, you know, any rational thinking human being goes, my God, why? I mean, you're number
right.
One, you're a drug dealer, which, as if that's not bad enough,
uh-huh.
You're tricking users into into taking something that they may not even be prepared for. Why on earth would somebody do that?
You know why they would do that, Paul? Because I've actually researched this a lot. So it takes pennies to the dollar for them to take a drug like fentanyl and to press that and then sell it at the markup of a pharmaceutical-grade drug. So it becomes a crime of opportunity because the percentage of money that they can make by putting out poison at the same price. So the person who's buying it is paying whatever the street price would be for Xanax or whatever the street price would be for OxyContin, OxyCodone, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And for the dealers, the gangs, the distributors, the cartels, they're making a huge percentage markup on this. So
wow.
It's a crime of opportunity.
Wow, it's putting the life and soul of a person behind the dollars. Awful. Fiona, hang on. We'll be right back with
of
you.
Course.
The guest, Fiona Cullinan-Farin. The website for Cameron, forcameron.com. That's the website also for Cameron on Facebook as well. More about this pressed pill problem now that is starting to show up even more and more. And what can we do about it? More on that coming up. Traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. The Facebook page is for Cameron, the website for Cameron.com, Forcameron. Cameron was the son of our guest, Fiona Cullinan-Farin. And 3 years ago, as Fiona said this week, he fell to the scourges of fentanyl. Unbeknownst to him, it was in a pill. This is now a problem, a pressed pill problem. Folks unknowingly, for whatever reason, buying these substances, but drug dealers fooling them essentially into thinking they may be taking something far, far less potent. Fiona, what's the goal here now? I know part of it is to bring awareness to this, which obviously you're doing a great job at, but what would you like to see happen? You were successful the first time you got the General Assembly to move. What's the plan here now?
Well, you know, the first thing is to bring awareness to this, Paul, because we're going to come out of this pandemic, and we are still going to, in Connecticut, be in the midst of an opioid crisis with numbers that are rising sharply every single year. Just so you know, New Haven County, not New Haven City, but New Haven, the county, had the highest rate of fatal overdoses in the past year. That rate is 44.8%. And that's unacceptable to us. We've been at this now 3 years, these families that you mentioned, mm-hmm. and it is unacceptable to us that we are not seeing a reduction in the lives lost to fatal overdoses. In terms of the pressed pill problem, I think the first time is there needs to be a lot of awareness because, you know, we're not talking about the days. There's this misconception around this, Paul. So people hear fatal overdose and they immediately assume somebody bought a baggie of something, which sometimes has happened, all right? Sure. They're thinking heroin and syringe. The minute you mention that somebody died of a pill, I think they almost revert in their mind as if we're back in the golden era in Hollywood and people are mixing too many Xanaxes and too many cocktails.
Quaaludes and
they're not
understanding.
Exactly. Yeah. Instead of understanding that somebody thinks they're getting one thing and they're getting something else. Now, if we were talking about anything that other than this problem, because it falls under the heavy stigma of addiction, we would be talking about manslaughter, right? If somebody asked for a bottle of tequila because the package store was closed, so they asked someone they knew to sell them a bottle of tequila, and somebody just instead poured some, I don't know, antifreeze in there and labeled it tequila, and the person died, there'd be a murder investigation. And that ultimately is going to become our goal. I understand all about the overcriminalization. And we never, ever, there is not one of us who works on this who does not agree with that. We agree we cannot arrest our way out of this in terms of arresting people who are in the throes of addiction has proven not helpful.
Sure.
However, there have to be consequences for people who are knowingly pressing poison, selling that for profit, knowing that there's a good chance or knowing that definitely somebody's going to die when they take their pill, there need to be consequences for that. And that is the ultimate goal, is to find a balance in this and to start bringing some charges. Because without consequences, Paul, why wouldn't dealers do this?
Well, exactly. And Fiona, you illustrated it marvelously here. Yes, if I want to sell somebody a bottle of true liquor and it's liquor and you know, whatever happens to them after drinking it, I'm probably not going to face a criminal charge because I sold them pure liquor. But as you say, if I sell them antifreeze, something in the present law book would happen to me. And again, it seems like, Fiona, as you and your compatriots did the first time we talked about this a year and a half, 2 years ago, it seems like now you've latched on to an area that, you know, one would have thought, Fiona, would have been dealt with in the past, but apparently has not been.
Correct. That's what it feels like. And I don't think that people are disinterested, Paul. I think that they're unaware. I think the stigma against addiction has gone so deep and so long, and it's been viewed as, right, addiction was viewed as a bad choice. So when you heard that somebody died that way, you think, oh, they made an unfortunate choice. And so I don't think a lot of people are actually aware of what is going on in the market. You know, there was a celebrity TV host last month. Her name's, I'm not familiar with her, but her name's Laura Berman.
Okay.
And she lost her 16-year-old son because he bought what he thought was a Xanax off Snapchat. And it was fentanyl pressed to look like Xanax. I mean, we have a massive problem that is going to just keep quadrupling if we don't step up and make some very firm changes.
Yes, and Fiona, you know what, you're right. We don't want, you know, the end user is not really, I mean, yeah, okay, they may have broken a law, but you're right. They have a dependency, they were fooled. But somebody up in the chain, Fiona, the regional distributor, the kingpin, the drug dealer, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Stigma be damned. The way the anvil of the law has to come down on these people.
It just has to. It has to because, you know, if you started arresting people, so if you started investigating these cases of manslaughter and you arrested somebody in those cases, that sends a message out to that dealer distribution that maybe they, you know, they always know that they're taking a chance that they're going to get arrested. There's a difference between getting arrested for drug distribution and getting arrested for manslaughter, for essentially killing somebody, and that might serve as a deterrent. It should serve as a deterrent.
Yes, it should. Fiona, you know, continue to fight the good fight. My regards to your husband and everyone in this group and your family. Folks, the website is forcameron.com. Run it all together. The Facebook site is forcameron. And Fiona, I have taken the recording of your Zoom conversation this morning with State Rep Vin Candelora, Lisa Dean, and others, and I have put that on our station Facebook page here at WIC. So folks will be able to see that as well. Fiona, thank you so much, and keep us informed on this, please.
I will. Thank you, Paul, so much for always giving us a voice, because just your letting us get this out there potentially saves lives, so it's greatly appreciated.
I can only hope. Fiona, thank you. Take care, and we'll be in touch down the line, I'm sure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Paul. Bye-bye.
All right, folks, there you go. Fiona Cullinan Farine, the both the website and the Facebook page for Cameron. You heard the story. 3 years ago this week, he was felled by drugs. He did have a drug problem. He was coming out of it. He had a really good job. He was loved by his family. And, you know, in a moment, he took something that was told to him to be something that it wasn't. And he was a, you know, a healthy, you know, large guy, and the fentanyl that felled him, the police officers and narcotics officers in New Haven told Fiona and her family he was dead before he hit the floor. And he thought he was taking something else. And to think, as Fiona said, that there are drug dealers and kingpins who do this. Take those people and drop them in a hole. I'm serious. I've said this for years. And I have had high school friends who have been felled by drugs like this. So, folks, if you want to see the discussion between Fiona, Robert Lawler, Lisa Dean, and one of the friends of the program here, State Rep Vin Candelora, it's now on our Facebook page. The governor is pushing a plan to impose a mileage tax on certain trucks here in the state. And we're welcoming gentlemen back to talk about that. Joe Scully heads the Motor Transport Association, and now some local businessmen and women are actually running the numbers, Joe tells me, and they're figuring out what this tax may cost them and ultimately may cost you. Joe, it's Paul here again. How are you, my friend? How you been?
Paul, good afternoon. I'm all right. Thanks for having me back.
That's good, Joe. There may be some light at the end of the tunnel of this COVID thing. That's good. But now, Joe, and we talked about this. We've been talking about this tolls and whatever and fees and taxes for about two and a half years now. This mileage fee, this mileage tax, however you want to put it, is still looming. And you have some of your businesses putting names and faces to this. Of people who are saying, okay, if this goes through, this is how much it's going to cost me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a public hearing coming up next Wednesday in the legislature's finance committee. And so I thought now is the time where we've got to start talking, you know, humanizing this issue almost, right? This is a tax that is going to directly slam small businesses that are located right here in Connecticut. I know when you talk about tolls and the truck mileage tax, the only thing you hear about is, you know, we want to get those out-of-state trucks. Number one, you can't forget about the in-state small business trucking companies, and we have a lot of them, as you may have seen in this video that we just put out there. And number two, with a tax like this, this is what I call a failed policy. You know, other states have tried this and then gotten rid of it because it just doesn't work. There's no way to track it. There's no way to enforce it. So you're going to leave the state short of the revenue that they think it's going to get. And then they'll probably try to make up for that by raising rates again on the in-state trucking companies and stuff. So this is a bad idea all around. I'm hopeful that the legislature will be receptive and say, wow, geez, we don't want to crush our in-state businesses with a tax like this. We've got to look at something else instead.
Some of the people on this video and some of the quotes you sent me a link to the video too. For example, let's go to what Kurt Lindeland said of Connecticut mulch distributors. And folks, you've seen these mulch trucks. They're not small trucks. They're, you know, it's mulch. It takes up space. Kurt said estimated cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 to $150,000 a year, something that we cannot absorb. All of our customers are right here in Connecticut, small businesses, most of them family businesses. Now, listen, Joe, businessmen are very nice men and women, businessmen and women. They're community oriented, but they're not charities, Joe. You and I both know this. They're businesses. So if a gentleman like Mr. Lindland's company here, Connecticut Mulch Distributors, if they're faced with an extra $150,000 a year in expenses, one of two things is going to happen with that, Joe. And I'm not an economics savant, but I think I know this. Either they have to pass that along to their customers, or they may have to cut back on the number of hours that some of their drivers and other staff members work.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I mean, you know, that's a theme that we heard from our small businesses throughout the process. I can't absorb this. I have to pass it on. And you could pass it on in one of two ways, right? The charge that they charge their customers, you know, for each delivery would increase, or you could just put a separate line item on the invoice, truck mileage tax surcharge or something like that. And, you know, I think the customers, whether it's a small business landscaping company or a grocery store or a gas station, they get it. They deal in this stuff every day. They have to adjust their rates accordingly, too. So while there seems to be widespread recognition that, you know, and I got some responses from some folks already. Yep, just as we suspected, these costs will result in higher prices for consumers. Mm-hmm. I would just caution everyone. Let's not stop thinking about it there. Yes, it will be higher prices for consumers indirectly, but just directly on small businesses. This is a huge cost in one year to absorb, and we've got to come up with something else. This is not the answer here.
Joe Scully is the head of the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, representing businesses, large and small, who have trucks, many and few. More with Joe coming up straight ahead. Joe, hang on. Right back after traffic and weather together at 4:36 on WICC. A couple of more minutes with Joe Scully, our buddy who heads the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, the MTA of Connecticut, you know, representing businesses big and small with truck fleets big and small. There's a public hearing coming up. It'll be a Zoom-based, YouTube-based, or PC-based hearing next week regarding a mileage tax proposed by Governor Ned Lamont on what he calls the big trucks, the big rigs here in the state. Some numbers you give here, Joe, for example, and some folks are familiar with these companies, Bozzuto's in Cheshire, a major distributor. This is going to hit them, they say, at an annual cost of $1.3 million. Coastal Carriers of Connecticut, $175,000 minimum. Connecticut Mulch, we talked about them, $100,000 minimum. Joe DeGrand and Son, $50,000. Herb Holden, $40,000. It's a lot of money, Joe. You know, people that don't run these businesses, Joe, I don't think quite understand, even if they have a successful business, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 is a big bite to have to absorb.
Well, it's huge, and I mean, that's why we're doing this, right? The state, to be honest with you, I don't know what they did to come up with their calculation that this tax would bring in $90 million annually from everybody who pays it, right? I guess I would assume they have some sort of traffic counting mechanism somewhere, and they run some numbers, and $90 million. But they, I know for a fact, they did not try to, you know, determine the impact on, you know, a fictitious company A that had 5 trucks or company B that had 10 trucks. So that's what we're doing, is we've got to show, you know, we're not just talking about the physical asset of a truck. These are people's livelihoods. It's small business owners and their employees, right? I mean, you know, one of the underrated aspects of this is, you know, it kind of pits big versus small. Big companies can deal with anything that's thrown at them. So I'm talking about big out-of-state trucking companies. Yeah. They can deal with this, but the small businesses located here in Connecticut, it basically would, because this is such an onerous tax with crazy reporting requirements and administrative burden, they're going to have someone dedicated to just keeping track of, how to pay this.
Trust me, Joe, they'll create some state jobs out of this. You know as well as I do, we're going to see the for hire signs out there, absolutely. In the figures you sent me, Joe, and I'm glad you did this because I always try and quote these figures. Look, Joe, I always say you can be for something or be against something. Just know what you're talking about. That's what I tell people. And you always send me this figure, and I'm glad you do, between average annual state-imposed highway fees on the state level and on the federal level. We're talking, Joe, according to these figures you gave me, that the average tractor-trailer operating and headquartered in the state is already paying, what, about $18,000 a year in fees and taxes?
Yep, it's $17,000 or $18,000 per truck per year, right? So I get a little cute with it sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I say, hey, if you want trucks to pay more because they're heavier, you got it. We already do. And it's through taxes that, you know, those numbers are made up of taxes that cars don't pay, like a 12% federal excise tax, an annual heavy vehicle use tax. There's a federal tire tax. You know, car drivers don't pay those things, so they may not be aware that they're there, but they are, and they greatly impact small business trucking companies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we got to put that money to good use, which unfortunately I just don't feel the state does spend its highway money very wisely. But we got to put that money to good use before we start going after more money from small businesses here.
And, Joe, one thing I know you always say frost you off, but I'm sorry, I'm going to have to mention it. When the governor gets out there or anybody gets out there and says, well, you know, the big rigs cause most of the road degradation and damage. And I know you and other experts I've talked to have said, well, wait a minute, that's not because of how these rigs are set up with their weight distribution. That's not necessarily true.
Yeah, exactly. That's an unfounded statement that there is no proof to back that up. But yeah, what I talk about sometimes is it's called the federal bridge formula. And to really dumb it down, it's just like it's load disbursement. Yeah. Yes, there is a lot of heavy weight on these tractor trailers, but with the number of axles that they have and how they are spaced out, we call that compliance with the federal bridge formula.
Yeah.
That ensures that a truck is not going to inherently damage a road or a bridge. You know, look, we're 5% of vehicles on the road. You know, if you want to talk about road maintenance, we got to talk about the salt and the chemicals that we put on the highways and the roads to treat them in the winter, and the plows scraping up pavement. And it, you know, it's stuff that we have to do. I get it. But, you know, there are so many causes of wear and tear on roads. To put it solely on trucks is just ridiculous.
All right, Joe, thanks. We'll keep an eye on this public hearing coming up via Zoom, of course. A Zoom public hearing coming up next week. Joe Scully heads the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, MTAC.us, online, MTAC.us. Joe, be good, and we'll speak down the line, my friend. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. Joe Scully there, Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. The limit now goes back, or the capacity level goes back for restaurants to 100% seating, of course, with social distancing, and restaurateurs all across the state loving that. Also, a couple of days ago, we finally got, apparently, sans any possible court challenges from Sportech, an agreement on sports gambling and iGaming as well. To address both of those, Republican State Senator Paul Formica back on the program. He represents part of the state where the casinos are located, and in his other life is a restaurateur. Paul, it's Paul here again. How are you?
Hi, Paul. How are you? Good afternoon to you and to everyone out there.
I'm well, Paul. Paul, you sound like you got a little hop in your step, so let's talk about the restaurant first. And I would imagine you, having for decades been a very popular restaurateur in the eastern part of the state, you must feel good that you and your staff can go back to 100% now.
Well, yeah, we feel, you know, very fortunate over the past year that we've, you know, been able to still be here. There are 800 or so restaurants across the state that, you know, can't say that. And it's been a devastation to this industry and the hospitality industry overall. But, you know, we're hanging in there. I have the greatest staff in the business, I think. And, you know, they've really worked awful hard and sacrificed an awful lot to get us to this point. So at 100%, you know, we're able to get there, but we're still socially distancing tables. And, you know, we're not quite back to the closeness that we had in pre-pandemic dining room.
Paul, let's talk about the other issue here. We finally, after a false starts for 4, 5, 6, 7 years about this and rumblings and the tribes being at odds with the governor's office, with the General Assembly, and then after another false start a couple of weeks ago, Paul, we finally apparently have at least an agreement in place now between the governor's office, both Indian tribes, the Connecticut Lottery to start some sort of, iGaming run under the lottery, and sports gambling as well. What are your thoughts on that? I know you represent an area that's got a lot of folks who work at the casinos and folks who go there. So from a legislative point of view, what do you think of the deal?
Well, I think, you know, it seems to be a fair deal. If everybody, you know, is a little bit uncomfortable with the deal, that usually means it's a fair deal. And you know, we need this opportunity to move forward to compete with our neighboring states. But more importantly, we need, this bill to pass providing for, you know, iGaming to support, you know, the two largest casino resorts in the world that you know, have become our fifth and sixth best job producers in the state of Connecticut, and who've suffered, you know, right along with everybody the last year or so. And you know, they got big overhead they had to carry, you know, to get to this point. So any revenue source that's going to help them move forward helps not only the employees and that great facility and driving the hospitality industry around, you know, eastern Connecticut and arguably all of Connecticut, but it has a great economic impact, and it provides, you know, over, I think, $9 billion to the state since they, you know, were started in the early 90s. And that 250-some-odd million that they provide each and every year from the slot revenue goes a long way to helping the state, you know, balance the budget.
Paul, obviously this has to go through a Bureau of Indian Affairs approval. You folks in the General Assembly will have to approve this. The tribes have already said, hey, we could get the iGaming and maybe the sports gambling. I mean, anything could be up and running by the middle of July. That may be a little optimistic, but it's good to hear that sooner rather than later. Although, Paul, the fly in the ointment could still be the folks at Sportech. It's been rumored that the lottery may want to contract them, but as you know, they've been running the OTB facilities in the state for years. How that may tie in, who knows? So I guess the last thing we would need here, and that would still slow this down, would be, again, another court challenge.
Well, no one wants court challenges on anything, but, you know, we've noticed over the last 20 years in whatever industry you're in, there's been you know, more and more court challenges on every decision, whether it's a government or business or whatever. But, you know, I think that, you know, there was a lot of consideration taking in to this deal so that there would be, you know, limited reasons for somebody to try to challenge it in the courts. The reason I think we got the deal this year is the governor finally came on board after a number of years of, mm-hmm. you know, kind of being hands off this issue. And one of his main concerns to be hands off was to, you know, any court challenges that were coming. So yeah. I think his direct involvement and the fact they were able to get this done and preserve the exclusivity while providing an opportunity for the state of Connecticut to generate revenue, I think will open a door for sports tech. We know DraftKings have already made a deal with the Mashantuckets. And so I think, you know, we don't know a lot what went on behind the scenes, but my expectation is that there were some considerations made and mm-hmm. and hopefully, you know, we can move forward. Because in this type of situation, when you deal with hundreds of millions of dollars, there's enough for everybody to go around here.
Yeah, and Paul, also, you know, in reading what I know about the bill, and I don't know what specifics you folks have read about it, but you keep seeing this number of 15 retail locations around the state. Interesting, I heard that Bridgeport's getting a few, Hartford maybe, New Haven not yet. They got to see what happens with Sport Tech. But, Paul, I would assume there'll be a scramble and everybody pushing you folks for, you know, where these 15 locations go in exactly what municipalities in the state in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I think that's going to be definitely a consideration. You may remember the last iteration, Paul, of this bill, when the entertainment zones were included in a legislation, I think that came out a couple of years ago to try to get, you know, brick and mortar casinos and other opportunities out there. And certain cities were named and you know, were intended to be a participant. Bridgeport, for example, you know, played a big role. So, you know, I think all of those things will be taken into consideration. The devil will be in the details of the legislation that is crafted, you know, but it's a good deal, you know, for everybody all around. And so hopefully it'll, you know, we'll be able to work out those situations and, you know, move forward for the best interests of the people in the state of Connecticut.
Republican State Senator Paul Formica, restaurateur and state legislator, and undoubtedly the guys and gals in the General Assembly of both parties now will begin peeling through in the coming weeks this gambling bill and see what happens and how many locations Bridgeport gets, Fairfield County, New Haven, Hartford, and all that. Paul, good luck this weekend as more folks maybe show up at the restaurant, and we'll talk in the future. Thank you, sir.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for having me on, and enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, Paul Formica there, Republican state Senate member who is happy now, as many legislators are, that both casinos are on board. Remember, the Mohegans came on board earlier in this, and then the Mashantuckets, the Foxwood people came on board after that. And apparently the hesitation at the beginning for Foxwoods was what tax they would be have to pay on the handle there. And they wanted 18%, the state wanted 20%, so they split the difference, and it's 18% or 18 point something for the first 5 years and 20% for the 5 years after that. So everybody, well, as Paul said, everybody either goes home happy or not happy, but everybody gets money, and that's it.